Well, hi again, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Godcast. My name is Father Alex. I'm the host of the Godcast. I'm also the author of Our Daily Bread from Argos to the Altar, which is a book which is available online and in all good bookshops. I'm also the vicar of St. Matthew's Church in Burnley. My guest on the Godcast this week is Andy Fitchett. Now, Andy is a blogger, he's a campaigner, he's a Methodist minister in the Methodist Church, of course, and it's great to get a different perspective from people who are Christians, but from a different denomination. So it's going to be really interesting listening to what Andy has to say. If you enjoy the interview, do check out the Godcast. Perhaps follow me on X at AlexDJFrost. Follow me on YouTube. There's loads of videos and interviews to enjoy. So for now, enjoy this interview with Andy Fitchett. Well, I'm delighted to say that joining me on the Godcast today is Andy Fitchett. Andy, it's great to get you on. How are you doing?
I'm doing really well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's great. It's great to get you on. Now, Andy, I'm going to ask you to kind of introduce yourself to people who may not be familiar with you, but you're a Christian minister. Just give us some context to who you are and where you are, if you would.
So my name's Andy. I am a minister in the south of England. So I'm currently in Hampshire, in Andover. But I'm minister of Andover and Hungerford Methodist churches. I've got pastoral responsibility for those churches. Originally a Baptist minister, so I kind of straddle between two different non-conformist denominations and help chair the Baptist LGBT network. So I'm co-director of that with my colleague Dawn. And I'm vice chair of Christians on the Left, which is the Christian Society of the Labour Party.
Well, I think a lot of people who are kind of borderline Christians, for want of a better word, might just say, well, what's the difference? What's the difference between a Baptist minister and a Methodist minister? How would you describe that to someone who wasn't sure?
It's slightly facetious, but it's also true. If you go to the back of a Baptist church and you find the bookshelf, it'd be full of Bibles. Go to the back of a Methodist church and look at the bookshelf, it'd be full of hymn books. And so those are I guess the other difference will be that at which point do you use water in baptism? Do you use it when someone's a child, or do you use it when somebody can say for themselves, yes, I want to become a Christian? But those are the main differences.
And some context to your own faith journey, Andy. Were you raised in a religious household? Just tell us how your faith evolved and brought you to the point of ordination, if you would.
Yeah, no. So I wasn't brought up a Christian at all. None of my family go to church. My sister used to, and my sister kind of dragged me along when I was a teenager, which is the kind of main impetus. But no, mum and dad, not faith background at all. But so my dad was raised a Catholic in Glasgow, but left the Catholic Church at the age of four, and is now, I think, the only Glaswegian Catholic to support Rangers. So I don't think he's actually allowed back in Glasgow. So that was his protest to not being part of the establishment. But there's no faith background in that sense. But my I guess as a growing up, I always thought there was something. I always hoped there was something more than what was around me. And I remember kind of watching Hercules when it first came out when I was a kid and being obsessed with the Greek gods, which is interesting because, of course, lots of the biblical stories and lots of the old New Testament writers were also obsessed with the Greek gods, but in a slightly different way. But it was interesting to somebody who wasn't brought up in any religious structure, to think about, actually, is there more to what we just see around us? So I had a really good religious studies teacher called Bev, and the church that I eventually started going to as a teenager ran what was called a Youth Alpha course, which is a kind of a youth course which explained the basics of Christianity in a particular tradition, which I don't identify with anymore, I have to say, but it was helpful at that point. And my sister went along, and then my sister dragged me along to it as well. And I remember being in a moment in one of those sessions thinking, well, if there is a God, then that changes everything. And if there is, then great, let's go with that. Because the worldview that I was being presented with, or not even the worldview, but the understanding of there being more, there being something greater, just resonated with me. And I remember saying to God, well, if you're there, great. Come on then, let's do life together. And I have this overwhelming sense of peace and love that filled me. And that was it. That was about 13, 14 at that point, got baptized. After that, and then was part of the part of the church ever since. It was 20 something years ago now.
I don't know if this has been your experience, Andy, but the deeper I got involved with my faith and the more I reached into theological study, etc., I suppose the more challenging it became. My faith was never really challenged, but obviously the questions get bigger, the controversies get bigger, don't they? Can you remember that experience in your own story, where you kind of trucking along quite nicely and then, oh, they think this or they think that? Where were the controversies for you and when did they appear?
I almost want to say every day. I'm very much someone who views the Bible as a book of questions and not a book of answers. And my understanding of the scriptures is these are people just like you and I who are writing stuff down, trying to figure out this God and the universe stuff as they went along. Inspired by God, absolutely. Inspired by the Spirit, absolutely. But just as flawed as individuals as you and I. And I think for me, the biggest crunch point would have been when I was studying theology, training for ministry. I had an absolutely amazing time studying. I've studied at Regent's Park College, Oxford. And it was a brilliant time to take time out and properly read scripture. But what was interesting, well, not just read scripture, but study all of kind of theology. And I was brought up in a very conservative, charismatic evangelical church, which was part of a network that was called New Frontiers. NFI, no females included, as it used to colloquially be called. And that was just, it was a sort of church which was full of lots of loving people, but if you didn't speak in tongues, you weren't a real Christian. It was that sort of church, really. And so I had that as my tradition, but never really fitted. It wasn't ever quite comfortable. It was like kind of putting on a jumper which was about three sizes too small, but it was all I knew. So I was like, well, this is what it must be me that's wrong. I must change then to make this fit somehow. And then when I went to study theology, I realized that actually it's about 5 to 8% of the church globally that think this. And there's a whole bunch of 2,000 years of Christian theology and 4,000 years of Judeo theology beyond that, where God is bigger. And the interesting thing about those moments was when it was a bit like kind of pulling the Jenga piece out, because you take one bit out and you go, okay, well, if Jesus didn't die because I did naughty things, which is what I was taught, because each naughty thing is changing with each generation, so perhaps that isn't right. Perhaps it was bigger. Perhaps it was about death. But then, how does that fit then with the and the whole thing kind of collapsed. And I had the joy of training where I was in college at Oxford Mondays and Tuesdays, study day Wednesday, and then in my local church as a minister Thursday, Friday, Saturday morning, and Sunday. And I remember standing up one Sunday morning ready to preach. And this was a kind of small, dying Baptist church. It was 362 years old when I took it over. Had about 18 to 20 people in it, absolutely bankrupt. And they thought, well, one last throw of the dice and we'll see what can happen. And by the grace of God, that church is still going now. It's on its third minister after me and going great, great guns. But I remember standing up thinking, I don't know even if there's a God. And I've got to preach. Great, this will be fun. And we muddled through and it was fine. I mean, I never kind of said it quite as bluntly as that to my congregation, but I did say to them, I stand here with more questions than I do answers. And I hope that's okay, because we're going to ask lots of questions together and try and figure out the answers as we go along. And they were very gracious in accepting that, which was good.
Did you experience much challenge to your kind of more inclusive thinking as you're maturing as a Christian? What was kind of the kickback? And did people try and convince you that what you were saying or what you were believing, suggesting that the Bible was a series of questions rather than the answers? What kind of responses were you getting?
Negative ones quite often, particularly around the issue, bizarrely, of sexuality. Oh, unbizarrely, should I say, because that's the biggest controversy in the church at the moment, how we treat LGBTQ plus people. But I remember when it was 2013, when the Same-Sex Marriage Act was passed, and then 2016, the Baptist Union responded, which said each church locally has the liberty to decide under the Holy Spirit how they want to deal with this. So if a church wants to register, they can, but if they but nobody's going to be compelled to do so. And then there was a line at the bottom which says, "But we urge people in grace not to do it." Which I thought was gracious towards those who held a view which you shouldn't. But it wasn't very gracious towards those who held a view which said you should, or you thought it was fine. So I wrote a paper called "God, Sex, God, the Church, and Sex" for my congregation, which was kind of looking at the six clobber passages, which you've often called them, the six passages which are often trotted out to say why people think same but why people think gay sex, not lesbian sex, but why gay sex in particular is a sin. And they're looking at the kind of arc of marriage over the years, and this nice fluffy idea we have nowadays that marriage has always been, or biblical marriage is often called, has always been this one man and one woman who fall in love with each other and live happily ever after. You go, that's not marriage in the Bible, and it's not marriage in history. Marriage was a political alliance in the upper echelons of society. It was not about love in the slightest. It was all about maneuvering. And in that maneuvering, often people were having it off with other people because they didn't actually want to be married to the person they were married to. So let's not pretend that marriage is this glorious thing which we've made it out to be today, when that's not the truth. So I kind of wrote this paper for the church, and this was me just saying I agree with that the church should marry same-sex couples, and I think that's in keeping with the biblical witness. And I lost some people. Some people left the church straight away, which was interesting. Some people said, the best one I have was, well, we think you're a heretic on this, so therefore you must be a heretic on everything else, which was interesting. And even, I remember saying, even as a politician at that point, I remember saying to them, well, yeah, but even a broken clock is right twice a day. Farage is wrong on most things, but I think occasionally he says something and go, that's reasonable, because even the most unreasonable people say reasonable things. Can you point to me what else I've taught you which you think is heresy in that? Oh, anyway, they couldn't, bless them. And then so those other friends sent my stuff to the Free Church of Scotland, to a minister that they knew, and he published a rebuttal online, which is very odd because I don't think I'm that important in the slightest to spend any time worrying about it. So yeah, it wasn't received well. But on the whole, we'd done a lot of work over the 4 years I was there initially to say, we're a church where we can hold difference, and it doesn't matter if we're going to disagree on secondary issues. Like, we've got the creed, that's kind of, that's it, that's we're not going to change that. But on these secondary issues, we can hold together with grace. And on the whole, until they fired me for coming out as gay, on the whole, we did it quite
Oh,
well.
they fired you for coming out as gay.
Yeah.
Wow. Just tell us about that, Andy.
Yeah. So I got married when I was quite young. So I was 21. My ex-wife was 19. We got married, which is young for nowadays. I recognise, going back, that was quite an average age to get married. But for 2012 was quite young for us. And we were, kind of standard evangelical Christians. Did all the things we should and didn't do the things we shouldn't do, and those sorts of things. And had a really happy life in many, many different ways. As I've said before, when I've discussed this, on the front of it, on the face of it, we were married. We had a lovely. We bought our house. We had a Labrador, a Volvo, Hunter Wellies, child. I was a local councillor and a minister. Zoe was an artist. It all looked fabulous, and it was a really happy life in so many ways. But when my son was coming along, and was before he was born, I suddenly had a bit of a crisis of thinking, gosh, I don't know how to be a dad, and I don't want to mess this up. So my dad left when I was a kid, and his dad had left him, and I was like, I need to break this pattern. And it absolutely freaked me out, because I was like, I've never had that role model. What do you do? It's like my grandparents died when I was really young, all four of them. And so they're never around. And so when I suddenly have, like, my son had grandparents, I was like, well, what do you do? Like, what's your? And now I know they're glorified babysitters, which is really helpful. But you feed your children with chocolate and sweets and then send them back to the new hyper, which is always a joy. But my son was coming along, so I went to counselling, and it was really interesting. After the first counselling session, a lovely counsellor called Alison, who was just like Jesus with flesh on, I adore her to pieces. And she said to me at the end of the first session, the parenting thing, you'll be fine. Nobody writes a book. Be present, be loving, and have clear boundaries which are fair, and the same ones each time. So there's good. So other than that, you can't really go wrong. And life will throw stuff up, but no one knows what's going to happen. So there's no point worrying about that sort of stuff, which is really quite a helpful thing to say. But then at the end of the session, she went, "But I'd quite like to talk about sexuality." And I was absolutely floored. I was like, "Why would you want to do that?" And so we ended up having a really long conversation after that, and it, what ended up being kind of nearly 2 years of counselling. And so by the time I got to the end of the counselling sessions, my son was was 18 months by that point. This would be Christmas, roughly Christmas 2016, about that sort of point in life. And she said to me for Christmas, "I think we're only going to need one more session because actually you're making really good progress." I was like, "Okay." And over Christmas, thinking, I don't feel like I am making good progress. What does that mean? And then I don't know, by the grace of God or just the way it worked out, I ended up getting the flu over Christmas, and I mean like proper flu. Like if there was 50 quid on the floor, you wouldn't bend down to pick it up. So hallucinating for 3 days in bed, body aching for 10 days, which is really inconvenient for a minister over Christmas, I have to say. So we had this big blowout carol service where we'd ask the entire town to vote for their top 10 carols, and then we're going to sing them at the carol service, and we invited everyone to come along. So we had about, I think it was 123 people, 122 people, sorry, squished into this small Baptist chapel, which had only seated 80 normally. And it was brilliant. And then I got home and went, "Oh, I feel a bit achy." And then that was me done until the 5th of January. I was just in bed. But what that meant was I then had 10 days in bed just thinking and kind of processing life and the universe. And eventually came to the conclusion that the reason I didn't feel I was making good progress was because although I admitted to myself I was probably bisexual, actually that wasn't true either. That didn't, again, it was like putting a jumper on, which was kind of three sizes too small. That didn't fit either. And why was my brain in such a state? So I admitted to myself that I was gay. I said it out loud. I'm a bit of an extrovert, and said it out loud and had this kind of out external conversation with myself, which makes me sound completely insane, I know. And then I just cried for days because I knew from that moment everything changed. Everything I knew, everything I had, everything I worked changed. And then I did the really brave thing of just hiding for about 8 months and hardly talking to anybody. Really withdrew into myself. Because I guess my subconscious was thinking, if you don't have conversation, then you don't have to have conversation about that, and you could just kind of carry on as long as possible. In the middle of this. So that was Christmas 2016. April 2017, Theresa May comes back from Easter holidays and walking in the Lake District and says, "I'm going to call a general election." And then I've chosen as the candidate to run for Parliament in North West Hampshire. So suddenly my face is going through every single door within a 30-mile radius and thinking, this is very exposed. What if somebody finds out? So eventually I came out properly to my wife in August. She asked me to ha if I was having an affair, and I said, "No, I'm not." She said, "Well, you've withdrawn from me. I don't know what other explanation." And I said, "No, actually, the truth is much worse." And I'm hearing myself saying, "No, don't, like, just don't say it. Just you could deal with this. Like, just keep going. It's fine. We can cope." And I said, "No, the truth is much worse. You know, I thought I was bi, and actually, that's not true. The truth is, I'm gay." And the first thing she did was she threw her arms around me and said, "That must be really painful for you." And I expected to be hit, and then she hit me, and that was fine, but like in a kind of frustrated way, not in a violent domestic abuse sort of way. So then we decided, well, we've got to tell the we had a couple of weeks off of just thinking through life and what do we do, and can we stay together, or can we. And I remember saying to her, "Look, you're 25 and you're beautiful. You're going to find somebody who can give you everything you want in life, but that can't be me. And I can't promise to not mess up over these next 60 years if we stay together." So we then told the church, and the first meeting was fine. We still love you. You're still our minister. We still care for you. And it's good Baptist practice. We called a meeting 2 weeks later for prayer and reflection. And it was clear that there was lots of kind of conversations that have been happening behind closed doors. And then what happened was my worst experience of church ever. I sat there at the front of church with me, the church secretary, his wife for some reason, even though she holds absolutely no position in the church in terms of the structure, and then my ex-wife just facing the congregation, and it was 2 hours of why we don't want Andy to be the minister anymore, chaired by a regional minister, which is like a Baptist version of a bishop, but with even less authority than a bishop has, and. And yeah, it was hideous. It was absolutely hideous. And at the end of it, the church secretary said, the only question we've got to ask is, do we want to be known as the church with the gay minister? And I don't. And that was it. That was the end of the meeting. So we yeah. So then they presented me with a contract which said, termination of contract of employment in the interests of the church and the minister. And I crossed out and the minister and signed it because I'm petty. But yeah, it was pretty hideous. And I had 18 months out of ministry of working for various charities and just trying to working for various charities, going through a divorce, moving house, trying to still raise a child half time. It was stressful, but in a much better place now, and in a denomination within Methodism where the only question they ask is, do you have sugar in your tea? And that's the only question that they care about, which is marvellous.
Gosh, Andy, I mean that's an exceptional lot of stuff that you've dealt with there, isn't it? I mean, I'm absolutely flabbergasted. My heart's almost bleeding for you for the pain that you've been through there. And
Churches can be brilliant, they can be heavenly, and they can be hell on earth because they're full of people, right? And people are inherently screw ups. But I think it's all the more painful when churches mess up because they're meant to be better. I think this is the thing which I talked about to my friends who are Christians, and I talk to my congregation about all the time, which is we're meant to be better than what we see around us. We're meant to be better than the kind of consumerist, your values based on your economics. We're meant to be better, and then when we're not, it just feels like we fall harder. But what I find interesting is that I think we should be better. Society doesn't think we're better and thinks we're actually much worse because we pretend to be better. And we've particularly seen this stuff with Soul Survivor that's come out recently. I mean, I was the Soul Survivor generation. I went to 10 in a row when I was growing up as a teenager. I remember that coming out and sadly not being surprised at what I was reading. But just thinking, oh, for God's sake, literally, like, for God's sake, can there not be one non-screw up in a church institution? But to counter it, what I would say is there are pockets where the church is doing better, and I think Methodism, for all of its flaws, like, and there are lots of flaws. Like, if you think there are lots of processes and structures in the Church of England, I mean, it's. Going from the Baptist Church to going to Methodism in terms of the structure of the church is like going from playing Playmobil to going to Meccano. And it's like, I just don't understand how this works. And for all its flaws, they've got this thing right in terms of inclusion. Because there's a space which says you don't have to agree with the theology, which is that, same-sex marriage is biblical. There's still space for you, but our theology is that we think that this is compatible. But you're still welcome if you don't think that, and that's okay. And a couple of years ago, 2021, when Methodist Conference, which is the governing body of the church, voted on whether or not to allow churches to perform same-sex marriages. So ministers could be in them but not perform them, which was a bit odd. The church voted 85% in favour. I said, yes, absolutely. I can't think of any other denomination which would be
No.
anywhere near that. The Baptist Union have just gone through a consultation about whether or not. So Baptist Union's the other way around. Churches can do, but ministers who are accredited are not allowed to be married. And they've just voted no, and they voted no. They're going to keep the rules. You're not allowed to. And now there's a kind of big push from the evangelicals to say, well, we've got to go further. We've got to become more conservative because we've got to make sure this never comes back again. And it's like, you've just won. Like, piss off. And so it just, yeah, church can be great, but church, as you know, can also,
Yeah,
it just be really wrong.
I sometimes I in previous things I've described sometimes it feels like you're working for Harrods, but then other times you're working for Woolworths, and the whole thing is going to collapse at any minute, you know. But I just want to return back to the way you talked about your marriage, Andy. I think that was quite beautiful the way you described that, actually. You know, that was to me somebody showing so much love and concern for their spouse by doing what you did, and people watching that must think, you know, that must have been so difficult and painful, and we haven't even gone into the fallout of that and the weeks and the months afterwards, that and even now. But I just want to say, what listening to you, Andy, that is just That's a profound expression of love, as far as I'm concerned, the way you dealt with that. You know, this wasn't about cheating or domestic abuse or something like that. That wasn't the cause of the.
No.
It was just about you being honest about what you were and who you were. So thank you, Andy. I've got to question three.
Pleasure. Yeah.
Great.
Great.
But I just it's been so fascinating listening to you. I wonder what you think. I sit on the Church of England General Synod, and those deliberations and conversations that you've been expressing about same-sex relationship and marriage are absolutely unraveling day by day, hour by hour, minute by minute in the church. And there are the progressives like myself who are trying to push the church in a direction which the Conservatives clearly don't want to go. You know, and I hold the view like you do. You know, we can live in tension. If you don't want to do what you don't want to do, you don't have to do what you don't want to do. But you can't and you shouldn't be able to stop me. I wonder how somebody such as yourself, and who's not part of the great old institution that is the Church of England, views it from the outside. You know, how do you see it, and how important is it for the wider church that the Church of England makes progress on this?
If I can answer them in reverse order, if that's all right. I think it's important that the Church of England makes a decision either way, but particularly, ideally, makes progress on this, because the media always writes the church. When they talk about the Church of England, they always write the church. And it infuriates me as somebody who's a part of other denominations to go, no, it's a church. Like it is just one of the churches within England, where there are, but there are hundreds of others. So I think because that is the perception of the church says no to same-sex marriage. That was the line that came out, wasn't it? After, oh, but we're going to do blessings of covenanted friendships, whatever the flippin' heck a covenanted friendship is. It was reported the church says no, and I was like, oh, no, it's a church. I mean, even recently, when the I can't remember what it was, the BBC had written an article about it, about same-sex marriage. It says the church doesn't marry same-sex couples, and I very rarely do I get pernickety about this sort of thing, but I wrote that the reporter and said that's not true. The Church of England doesn't do same-sex marriage, but the Methodist Church, which is the fourth largest church in the UK, does. And the Baptist Church allows people to do it, and the URC allows them to do it. So, like, just basic understandings of the kind of religious life would be helpful. But I think that's a wider societal thing as well, with the importance of the church dwindling in people's lives. So I think that for me, that one of the reasons it's really important the Church of England makes progress is because of the public perception, the way it's reported in the and the position that the Church of England holds, which I don't agree with. I want to see the Church of England disestablished. I'm a non-conformist. I don't think bishops or any clergy or any religious figure should sit in a legislature by right. I think that's really, really weird that we allow people who happened to be ordained in the right job get a vote on every single one of our laws. The only other nation, of course, to do that is Iran. Which is interesting. And actually, I think disestablishing the Church of England would free it from a number of different things. Fundamentally, I want to say, look, if you're part of the state apparatus and you want to hold that position as the state church, then sorry, you've got to abide by the laws of the state. And the laws of the state say that same-sex marriage or marriage of equal couples, however you want to describe it, is legal, and you don't get an exemption if you're part of the state. And you don't get exemption from the Equalities Act either, which is also what the Church of England gets. So I want to say, like, if you want to be as homophobic and as misogynistic, as racist as you are, fine, but you can't be the state church anymore. You have to go and be just an independent church like everybody else, and then you can do whatever and hold the theology you want. But that's a political point as well as a theological one, I guess. But I think from the outside, lots of us are just sitting here watching, going, why are you still together? It's like watching a marriage of a couple who absolutely hate each other but are staying together for the kids, and but the kids have grown up and left, because the age demographic isn't there anymore, and the kids are like, we don't care, like, we know you hate each other, why are you still married? Like, separate. I find it particularly interesting, of course, that the Church of England was established based on an issue of marriage. And 400 years later, is still having an argument about an issue of marriage. But I think most of us are, from the outside, would just be like, you can hold this together. But I would argue that those who are on the more conservative side don't actually want to hold it together. They want you to think what they think.
That's the point. That is the point, and that's it right there, you know. And I entirely agree with you. You know, I think I'm probably putting myself out on a limb here, but you know, I'm sitting on synod and I say it that, you know, there are people in the church who are doing exactly what you're saying and what want what exactly what you're saying. And I want to say to people, it's like we can hold this tension, we must hold this tension, and if we can't, then you can make your threats of leaving, but don't just leave them there as threats. Leave, you know, and let's get on with it and let's put the church back together from that point. Because it is, like you say, it's the messiest of divorces. And we just get, just to give some context for people who are listening or watching, you know, the Church of England has agreed that a prayer of blessing can be used. But the Conservatives fear that if that is allowed, then that leads to a change of doctrine, changes to marriage of same-sex couples, and that's where you get the resistance. And just as Andy's expressed, you know, I don't want people to do that. I wouldn't want to be married if I was a gay person. The last thing I would want to be married is by somebody who held that abhorrent view that a same-sex relationship is wrong. But we're almost afraid to upset each other. We're almost afraid to be bold enough to say, this is what needs to happen. Let's get on with it. And I'm just keep saying, let's get on with it, you know. So I appreciate your thoughts, Andy, on that. And it's important to hear what you said. And I agree with so much of what you said. Andy, we've almost run out of time. I really wanted to get onto politics and all sorts of things with you. But I think one of the overriding things for me is that while this battle of inclusion rages in the church, it almost infiltrates on the need to call out injustice and poverty and so many things that are going wrong in our society. I just wondered if you could offer a brief comment on your work, you know, in calling out people who are affected by things like the cost of living crisis. It's very much real living daily thing here in Burnley. Just a few thoughts, if you would, please.
What I find fascinating is that no matter, there is not a pocket of the country you go to, whether or not where there are not people who are having to decide now whether to eat or whether to pay another bill. And I live in fairly leafy North Hampshire, and yet in my town we give about 5,000 food boxes every single year. And this is an area in the southeast, which and often is characterized as, oh, that's fine. Well, actually, it's not, because house prices are so ridiculously high. And mortgage rates are so high, and train fares into work are so high. The same issues are everywhere. I often get told that you can't mix politics and religion, or I should make a decision, either do politics properly or do religion properly, rather than doing them both. I guess the thought process is that I don't do either of them very well. but my candidacy for the general election coming up is just about to be announced. So I'm standing again to try and become the MP for this area I'm currently in, which is where I was brought up. And the thing is, I often say to people, absolutely, but you can't pray poverty away. Getting rid of poverty is a political action. And if not, I'm not going to try and do something about it because I'm spurred on by my faith and because I'm spurred on by what I see. Then who is? Who's going to be the one to do it? I get frustrated when I see people or hear people when I meet them in surgeries, or if I was a counselor, and they go, oh, well, you should be doing this and you should be doing that, and you should, and I say, no, you should be doing it. If you think you could do a better job as being a counselor, great, stand against me. And often they did, and they won, which was really annoying. Having stood, this will be my 10th election and I've lost eight, so I'm really good at losing elections, but that's also because I'm Labour in a very conservative area. But there's only so many times you can pray, Lord, please help those who are on a food bank, without thinking, actually, I want to change the structure so food banks don't exist anymore. And so the work we do is, you know, I do a lot of work with people who are addicts, and who are struggling with addiction. And we had an issue the other week where it was a Friday afternoon and the pharmacy had closed, and one of my people coming to my church had missed a meth prescription, because life is messy, because they're an addict and life is complicated, so they missed it. So and then the pharmacy didn't open till Monday, so they weren't going to have any of the weekend. So they're like, "Well, I'm going to go and find some heroin, or I'm going to go and use." And I was like, "No, don't do that. I try and do it," because it was the inclusion services, which is the in Hampshire, which is the workers who work specifically with addicts directly, rather to take away from the GPs. The GPs haven't got to deal with it all the time. Because it was inclusion, 111 couldn't give a new prescription, emergency one, because they can only give prescriptions which the GP have signed off. Now I spent 8 hours on the phone to and from going to pharmacies, and I don't, it's my job, I'm happy to do it. But in the morning, had somebody said, "Oh no, that was the inclusion, not the GP, I can't help you," fine, that would have been sorted. So now I'm thinking, well, why on earth is that the case? That's a ridiculous situation. The only way to change that sort of situation, which is a really simple change, is to do that through politics, is to do that through getting engaged, and trying to change the system by come hell or high water. And so when people say, "Well, you can't mix the two," I go, "No, nonsense. You've clearly not read the Bible or anything of Jesus. To call Jesus Lord, which is what we do, is to say Caesar isn't, right? It's a political statement, Jesus is Lord. Jesus is the Prince of Peace, which means Caesar isn't. It's another political statement." Sorry, I'm getting on my hobby horse now, so forgive me for going on a rant. But there is such an impetus in the country now for people who have integrity, who have morals, who have a desire to change stuff, and aren't going to be corrupted by the system, which so many often are. It infuriates me that when people say, "Oh no, you should keep them separately," I'm going, "You can't, because you can't pray for world peace unless you're going to work for it."
No, you can't. I think I always come back to Jesus's Sermon on the Mount, to call out injustice. In Burnley, we have an example where a decision has been made to give the town £7 million from the Levelling Up agenda to
Oh yeah.
repedestrianise about a mile and a half square of pavement. An alternative choice could have been to invest that into local services, to mental health support, all those kind of things. It's a political will that can't be changed. You can't pray that into, but you can pray for change, and so it's really important. So I'm glad we've had a chance to just to touch on that. So Andy, so people who want to find out more about you, where can they go?
You can follow my selfies and rants against the Tories on Twitter, just at Andy Fitchett, and the same at is everywhere for Instagram or Facebook, whatever.
Fabulous. Well, thanks so much for your time, Andy. Wish you well for the coming year. It's going to be a big election year, and all the best for your church and your parishioners and those that you serve in that part of the UK. So thanks for coming on the Godcast. Thank you.
No, thanks, Alex. Be blessed.